Hi, I'm Peter Santoscano. I produce the Climate Change Podcast, which you're about to hear. Before we begin this episode, though, I want you to know about a new resource for listeners. Each episode of Climate Changed will now have a discussion guide to accompany it. The guide includes opening and closing activities, an overview of the episode, and thoughtfully considered discussion questions. These discussion guides are designed to use in small groups, but you can also use the guide for your own personal reflections. Tyler Mark Nelson designed these guides for you and created discussion guides for every episode in Season 2. He also created guides for all of the episodes in Season 1. In our show notes, you will find a link to a corresponding discussion guide. My hope is that this guide will deepen the conversation Ben and Nicole bring you in each episode. And now, to the show.
You are listening to Climate Changed, a podcast about pursuing faith, life, and love in a climate-changed world.
Hosted by me, Nicole Dieroff.
And me, Ben Joshua Davis. Climate Changed features guests who deepen the conversation while also stirring the waters.
The Climate Changed podcast is a project of the BTS Center.
I don't know about you, Nicole, but it feels good to be back behind the mic.
Well, I can say I'm feeling at least a little more comfortable than I was when we were producing Season 1, which, as you know, was my very first attempt at podcast co-hosting.
And I have to say, you learned so much so quickly. If you are joining us for the first time, we will tell you what to expect from this episode and all the episodes in Season 2. In a moment, we will share an exercise to help ground and center us. Today, it will be a poem by Lilis Mellon Guinyard.
Then, you will hear the conversation I had with visual artist Rob Shetterly, a friend of the BTS Center and an inspiration to me personally. He has painted over 250 portraits of Americans who tell the truth.
I have already heard the conversation, so I am excited to chat with you about the questions, thoughts, and wonderings it brought up for me.
After Ben and I reflect on my conversation with Rob, we will end our show by offering you tangible, meaningful, and achievable next steps you might want to take after listening to this episode.
Now, to be clear, you don't have to do them all. These are just suggestions to have you on your own path to living and serving in a climate-changed world.
As we launch into Season 2 of Climate Changed, I feel like we should reintroduce who we are at least a little bit, considering it's been a year since Season 1 premiered.
All right. Nicole, what are five words that describe you?
Okay, five words. Minister. Mother, naturalist, relatively new Mainer. That might have been six. How about you, Ben?
Father, islander, researcher, home renovator. I'm actually curious about who is listening to us.
Ooh, me too. Okay, for those of you listening, what are five words that describe you? Feel free to send us an email and introduce yourself. Our address is podcast@thebtscenter.org. That's podcast@thebtscenter.org, and we would love to hear from you.
Before we hear Nicole's conversation with Rob, we will take a moment to center and ground ourselves. Lilis Mellon Guinyard's reading of the poem she wrote, The Great Reimagining. She first shared it publicly at the BTS Center's 2022 convocation.
The Great Reimagining, with thanks to Toni Morrison and Cole Arthur Riley. I want to know how it felt to be the first knitter to imagine the loops yarn could make to cup a heel without a seam. Each time I work the sock pattern, I cast a spell that transforms a long spun strand into three dimensions of warmth. And who was the brave stone whisperer, wedging the keystone above their head in the first dry-laid arch? Crazy, right? I mean, there were arched stone vaults hefted hundreds of years before power tools or Vermont. To what risky craftsman can I apprentice myself to learn to see in my mind what has never been seen, never achieved, and work backwards so that somehow the missing pieces fill themselves in without mortar, without falling on my head? To learn the physics of imagination, the equation that reduces fear to less than constructive curiosity. We know an object in terror stays immobile. We know horror films get made every day because it's so easy to imagine bad things happening to good planets. After all, the ice sheets come, the ice sheets go. But now we have our finger on the remote, pushing fast forward, as if the ending has already been written, as if pushing these buttons wasn't actually writing that ending. Stop. Breathe. Make believe. Teach our children this was not ordained. We must remember we are better than this. Back when the great dreamer imagined us, there was nothing to go by. Then there we were, in all our swimming, crawling, flying, slithering, climbing, walking glory, each a piece of creation, each a fragment of the almighty they's fantasy, roaming the hills, swinging in trees, willed into free will. Yet now we act like prisoners of creation, forgetting the gift, the risk, forgetting we're each a piece of the greatest imagination. Could we, do you think, spin back into pure possibility? Could we dream a little before we think, make a leap forward, trusting physics to fill the steps in behind us? Maybe if we believe that even we are worth saving, we can stop unraveling and hook our loop to the loops around us. It's time to turn the heel, to hold with our hands in the air above us the rock we lift from our neighbor's chest. Even as hands we don't know lift the rock from our own.
Thank you for that poem, Lilis. We now turn to my conversation with Rob Shetterly. Rob is the artist behind the portrait series Americans Who Tell the Truth, which includes people like William Sloan Coffin, Molly and Dana, Reggie Harris, Robin Wall Kimmerer, Brian Stevenson, Henry David Thoreau, and many, many more. Both well-known and rather unknown truth-tellers. Rob speaks with children and adults all over America about how democracy cannot function if people don't demand the truth. Rob is a fellow Mainer and beloved friend of the BTS Center. I really enjoyed having this climate change conversation with him. You are the artist behind Americans Who Tell the Truth, this incredible portrait project. What is this project and why do you do it?
Americans Who Tell the Truth is something that was born out of kind of a reluctance and rage, guilt, grief, you know, all these things that are not necessarily good reasons to start doing anything. Mm. But I was so distraught at the run-up to the Iraq War that our country was committed another set of war crimes, and that I, as a citizen of the country, was being made complicit in it. And I found that very hard to live with. I felt incredibly alienated during this time, as I felt during a lot of my adult life, from various policies of the United States. But I kept thinking, what can I do at this moment to feel less alienated and also maybe have some kind of voice? And I knew that it had to be through the thing that I do best, which is paint.
Yeah.
And it also needed to be positive rather than negative, because I was being held captive by an awful lot of negative energy.
Yeah.
My own. What it boiled down to was that I needed to exercise, literally, the spirits of the administration, the George W. Bush, Cheney, Powell, Condoleezza Rice, et cetera, et cetera, you know, who were promoting this illegal war, and get them out of my body, out of my heart, out of my head, and replace them with people who actually make me feel good about this country.
Yeah.
People who had spent their lives often, sometimes only one, done one thing, sometimes an entire life of trying to insist that this country live up to its own ideals. Mm. It began with one portrait of Walt Whitman that kind of reconnected me to the fundamental democratic impulse. I had never painted a realistic portrait in my life. So, I was an artist. I was a self-taught artist, so I knew how to teach myself how to do something. This portrait of Walt Whitman, I put it up in the foyer to our house as soon as I finished it, because I wanted to be looking at it myself. Within a couple of days, two or three people had come in, stood in front of the portrait, and burst into tears.
Wow.
And it wasn't because it was a terrible portrait, and it wasn't because it was really a great portrait. It was because with the portrait and then the quote that I'd written on it, which were Whitman's words about how to live in the world, I think people suddenly felt reconnected to this country in a way that they felt so upset about being in. It was that kind of healing I noticed was not just my own.
Yeah.
But other people could use these to help heal themselves too.
Beautiful.
At the beginning, it was an art therapy project.
Yeah.
I was just trying to figure out some way to live in this country and feel comfortable.
Yeah.
It was by surrounding myself with these portraits that I thought I was going to do it. And then it mushroomed, and then people started to respond to it. Mm. And now it's something I never expected.
How many portraits are you up to at this point, Rob?
I'm not absolutely sure, but I think it's close to 270.
Amazing. There are several themes and threads in your portraits, but environmental justice is one that, of course, stands out to the BTS Center, as we have been working to cultivate spiritual leadership for a climate-changed world. Who is someone who you have painted that you would consider to be a spiritual leader? And let's define that really broadly, a really broadly defined spiritual leader in a climate-changed world.
The project began about militarism. Mm. But very quickly, as I began to add other voices, it became kind of a chaotic cacophony of voices, which is another word for intersectionality. Mm. I would like to define the problem first through one story. Mm. There's a man named Eric Ries, who's a professor of English, and he's a poet, a writer himself at the University of Kentucky in Lexington, who a number of years ago, when I was traveling around West Virginia and Kentucky painting people who were resisting mountaintop removal coal mine, I met Eric Ries because of a book he'd written. He wrote a book called Lost Mountain. And that was the literal name of a mountain that he went and studied that was being taken down over the process of a whole year by a coal company. Mm. What they did, in case people listening don't understand what mountaintop removal coal mining is, these big companies realized that they could save a lot of money by automating their process in such a way so they didn't have to hire coal miners to go dig tunnels under the mountain and scrape out the coal from the seams under the mountain. Instead, begin to blow off the upper layers of the mountain down to the various seams of coal, scrape them out, blow it up some more, scrape them out, all the time dumping the forest, the animals, what they call the overburden, down in the valleys, polluting the rivers and streams. So Eric Ries studied what happened on that mountain. First, what happened to the life above it, because those Appalachian forests are the richest, most diverse forests in North America. So they bulldozed those forests with no regard for anything, right over the side of the mountain. They didn't even harvest the wood. And of course, just by doing that, they destroyed the lives of so many Appalachian people who lived in those forests, who found herbs in those forests, who knew who they were because of those forests. So they did that, and then they would start blowing up the mountain. So Lost Mountain became literally lost after this. And he wrote this wonderful book about that process. what I wanted to get to about that was that he said, our most modern sin is that we have not loved the world enough. We have exiled the holy from this realm so that we might turn its mountains into money. For me, that statement is so apt for a economic system, a culture, a society, a country that decides that the exploitation of nature, of people, of other species, and the profit that could be taken from that is superior to any other use. Yeah.
I'm interested in the methods of truth-telling that you have encountered as you've engaged with these more than 250 Americans who tell the truth.
That's interesting, Nicole. There's so many ways. And often they are so particular to a particular time or a particular moment. What a person can do, being able to strategize what is the right thing to do at a moment is as important as what you say itself. When is this method the way that's going to be most effective? I'm thinking right now of someone like Tim DeChristopher, who, by the way, now lives in Maine. Tim DeChristopher was a student at the University of Utah back in 2008 at the end of the Bush administration. This is George W. Bush, when he wanted to give a gift to the oil and gas and coal companies as he left office by opening up all this public land in Arches National Reserve and those parks, those beautiful, fragile, gorgeous Red Rock parks in southern Utah. He wanted to open this land up to fossil fuel exploration. And Tim DeChristopher, who was a penniless student studying economics at the University of Utah, heard about this, and then he found out where the meeting was going to be, where the various companies were going to bid on the land that they were going to get to do their explorations and then possibly their exploitations of these fossil fuels. He was planning to go there to interrupt the meeting in some way, just to show that somebody knew what was happening, that this public land that belongs to all of us was being given to these coal and oil companies. He found out where the meeting was. He went to the door in the hotel. They assumed, because nobody's supposed to know, that he was a bidder, and they gave him a paddle to go in and start bidding. He ended up using that paddle and bidding $22 million and buying thousands of acres of land. And before he was discovered that he didn't have any money, and he was doing this only to interrupt the process, he eventually was put in jail for 2 years for doing that. And while he was in jail, he was given a full scholarship to Harvard Divinity School because of the publicity about this. Once it became known to people and the embarrassment of it to the government, the land was taken off the market. It was saved. And as far as I know, it's still saved. There's a strategy that's very different from standing in front of a microphone. It's committing a kind of civil disobedience and being willing to take responsibility for what you've done, not run away from it, but instead embrace it and then pay the consequence, which also helps to complete your mission. Right here in Maine, you know, someone like Russell Libby, who started the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. Again, this isn't so much about speaking, but it's building an organization which brings together organic farmers and people who want to be organic farmers or people who want to support organic farming because they know how environmentally and politically important it is, and building a very powerful organization that can not only support all those farmers, but also becomes a strong political voice that is advising political candidates about what bills and policies they should be supporting. That kind of thing, that building of an organization, is another particularly powerful way to become a voice in these issues. I was just thinking of Robin Wall Kimmerer, the great Potawatomi Indigenous writer, who I'm sure you've talked to. Her writing, because it's so powerful in that the intersection between indigenous knowledge, botany, scientific lore, her own personal story, and by combining all those things in a very beautiful and humble and gentle way, is able to help an awful lot of people understand how we need to be living if we're going to survive on this planet, and not just us, but all the other species that are on the planet too.
Yeah.
That isn't really the same as a voice in front of a microphone. It's taking the time to craft a message that almost anybody can understand.
Beautiful. Robin Wall Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass is something of sacred text to me for sure. And her method of writing really is a beautiful way of truth-telling. I have heard you say that truth-telling that points at hypocrisy is especially dangerous. I often view your work as really looking to those places where there's hypocrisy and those who are trying to unveil that. We have been at the BTS Center thinking quite a bit about shifting from sort of individual truth-telling and potentially individual experiences of hypocrisy to collective truth-telling. One of the people you've painted, Reverend Dr. William Barber II, who is a Disciples of Christ pastor, formerly president of the North Carolina NAACP, Reverend Dr. William Barber II said, "The role of the church is to engage in the dangerous ministry of telling the truth." So the danger is highlighted there, but also the collective, putting actually an institution in a responsible place for telling the truth.
A lot of the great labor unions, and I paint a lot of labor people.
Yeah.
You know, we think of the International Workers of the World and Mother Jones, Bill Haywood, people like that. They were dangerous because they were doing these radical strikes at a time when there was no appetite for these strikes at all. And the government could easily call in quasi-military forces, put them down and beat them up, shoot them, drag them off to jail, and you would never hear of them again, practically. That kind of danger, you know, often is a kind of radical solidarity, where you know that you're standing in solidarity to the victims, and there are many victims. In this case, say with the labor unions, victims of people being victimized and exploited in mills or coal mines or on the railroads or wherever it was that they was being victimized. People like Code Pink, they're thinking of Iraqi citizens or Syrians or Yemenis, where the U.S. is selling all these weapons to Saudi Arabia to destroy that country and kill so many civilians. Somebody has to stand with the victim. Somebody has to take that on themselves. Being willing to have that kind of solidarity is a very dangerous thing.
I think you're going to keep painting portraits for a little while, but if you were to imagine painting just that interconnectedness, that solidarity, that communal sense, do you have a vision of what that painting would look like?
Protests at Standing Rock.
Hmm.
You had all these people coming, not just Native people, but a huge Veterans for Peace contingent and other people from all over the country in solidarity with, partly with the Native people as they stood against that pipeline and being put across their land under the Missouri River, the possibility of almost the surety of it eventually breaking and poisoning so much. That kind of vision is not about a hero. It's about a collective of people who understand that sometimes the common good can only be protected by the common people. They have to do it themselves, and the more they are that are willing to take that risk of being part of that, the stronger they are. As we talk about these issues, we know we're talking about power. There's no way a group of indigenous people from some tribes in the Dakotas can have the financial power of enormous oil and pipeline companies. And they don't have the access to the law the same way those companies do, or to the control of the law, or to politics, or anything else. However, what they do have is they have the courage of not giving up. When they can do that as a collective, that has extraordinary power.
Yeah.
That ability can make all the difference.
Rob, I'm really grateful for this conversation this morning, and for your very good and important work in the world. I encourage you, as you find people who are living and telling the truth and able to find ways to share their messages with others through your art. It's a beautiful project. We're so glad to be related to you at the BTS Center through the ways that we've worked together. And I offer you blessings on this day.
Thanks, Nicole. And thanks for this opportunity. And thank you so much for what you do.
Thank you.
What a powerful conversation you had with Rob Nicol. I was really struck by all the people that he named. It gave me hope. Just a reminder of the incredible courage and graciousness and generosity that is also a part of what it means to be human. And I was also particularly struck by this phrase he used near the end of your conversation of how the truth-telling is actually about a collective of people. It got me reflecting on the number of different modes that Rob Shetterly introduced for what it means to tell the truth, from disruption to storytelling to organization building, all both within individual but most frequently collective contexts. It seems to me that our culture actually has a really monolithic view of truth-telling. What does it mean to stand up and tell the truth? And generally, we have this image of like the one courageous individual engaged in protest. In some ways, like that's the best conception. And the worst is this understanding of like telling the truth is putting an obnoxious, self-righteous post on social media and walking away.
I've been thinking a lot about what truth-telling looks like for faith communities. The two descriptions you just gave aren't really the right modality for faith communities to take. I've been probing people talking about lament, which is something that runs so deep in our faith traditions and is expressed in Christian scripture. Lament is this way of being together in saying that something is not right, saying that as an expression to the divine, expressing to the divine that something is terribly wrong and we need to move in a different direction. One example of this comes from a colleague of ours who has been watching trees be removed from the downtown area in her town. She decided to bring together some people to have a funeral for those trees and to share publicly that this is worth mourning and worth being upset about. I loved how Rob talked about the courage of not giving up. And that colleague has actually facilitated more than one tree funeral because the trees keep being cut down. They keep having red string tied around them, marking that they're coming down. And so she has gathered several people together who are not giving up and will keep continuing to lament the loss of those trees.
I was thinking about our colleague as well when I was thinking about this and how every time she comes back to us in conversation and talks about the trees that she is holding funerals for, it brings tears to my eyes. I'm in a small community, 400 year-round residents. These are the people who you're with. So you're always negotiating truth-telling within the context of ongoing relationship. You can't just blow someone off the face of the earth and then walk away because you're going to see them on the boat, you're going to see them on the road, you're going to see them at community gatherings. So truth-telling always has to be done within the context of relationship. And that is often tender, messy, vulnerable work that you have to come back to again and again and again. Sometimes as well with lament, knowing the truth that you want to share, they may never be able to hear. And so you still have to find ways to be in relationship together and to mourn the ways that your relationship will never be what you hoped it will be. I also find that truth-telling sometimes is also about reframing. We often think about truth-telling within the context of political binaries. So is this progressive or is this conservative? And certainly we live in a culture that is not just more polarized culturally, but is actually kind of polarized in its frameworks for understanding the world. And oftentimes I find what truth-telling also is about finding ways to break down those binaries and offer people new frameworks for understanding the world around them. That's where I'm actually really, really grateful for the resources that come from my faith as a Christian, because it gives me some ways to enter into this conversation that don't have to be defined by our dominant cultural and political discourse, and can speak a word that everyone can come around. On the island, that's the beach that we're going to have to hold a funeral for, and we have common ground because we all know this place and we love this place. I recently gave a talk at a scientific conference on water about what faith leaders can teach us about coping with existential fear and dread, speaking to a group of scientists and climate engaged folks, especially some young students. And I found that the Christian understanding of hope, which is that hope is not optimism, but rather that it's a virtue, it's something you practice on a regular basis, was an incredibly good word to all the people in that room coming from all sorts of different contexts. It gave a new language and vocabulary that spoke to a world where one of the things that does unite us, conservative or liberal, is our understanding of power and that we're responsible for going out and changing the world. And if we can't change the world, then there's something wrong with us. So being able to go in and offer a frame that says, you are not responsible for changing the world. And incidentally, I just want to pause and say to any of you who are listening here, if no one's ever told you this before, you are not responsible for changing the world. That is not in our pay grade. All we're responsible for doing is what we can in the context that we can. And found that there were multiple people in the room who said, I've never heard anyone say that to me before. That's also truth-telling because then it gives us new frameworks and a new perspective to engage with the work that we're doing in a new way that is hopefully more sustainable and more life-giving as well. That to me is also a big part of what it means to tell the truth.
Thanks, Ben. As you were sharing, I also was thinking about the ways in which our great teacher in the Christian faith, Jesus, told the truth, which in those stories, it's so often through metaphor or through a question asked back to whoever is speaking with him, or through storytelling, through imaginative storytelling. And I'm now left thinking about how we can do more truth-telling through metaphor and question and story.
I also think part of that is there's a truth-telling that we can do by inviting people simply to notice what's around them. Jesus did this all the time and saying, pay attention. Consider the lilies of the field. Consider the sparrows that you see all around you. There's something important here about truth-telling also being about noticing what's going on around us. One of the things I really appreciated in Rob's conversation is actually the way he invited us to notice what was going on in new ways. He used this quote that really stuck with me. We have exiled the sacred from this realm so that we might harvest a mountain for money, when he was talking about the story of mountaintop removal. And that kind of reframes our work in a different way. It's not just about the tragedy of this mountain being brought down. It's not just about kind of the ecological side effects. It's not just about capitalism. It's not just about fossil fuels. But there are actually some spiritual root causes to what's going on that we can notice if we kind of sit up and pay attention.
This is something we've been exploring really deeply at the BTS Center. Root causes like colonialism, domination, extraction, consumption, as root causes of what we are talking about in terms of carbon at this point, connecting back with the ways in which we exist in an economic system that rewards individualistic, short-term, and rather placeless decisions. I so appreciated the way in which Rob's stories pointed towards that. If part of the challenge is having exiled the sacred in order to make money, how do we bring the sacred back in?
I think part of what we're doing is trying to teach our children to ask questions by asking them questions. And our son Michael is now getting old enough that when he sees us doing something that doesn't line up with our values, like he's beginning to ask questions of us. So, you know, we go on the rare occasions where we can find takeout, which is not very often on the island, and you bring home everything in these plastic or styrofoam containers. And he's saying, wait, why are you doing that? Doesn't that hurt the earth? And then we have this wonderful moment of like mutual truth telling together. I also think increasingly for me, it's about teaching my children to notice. Practices like I'm walking with my children through the forest with Merlin, the birding app from Cornell, being like, oh, do you hear those birds? Let's figure out what those birds are and what those calls are. And I find that's also a process of truth-telling, helping them wake up to the world.
I'm thinking about the ways in which Robin Wall Kimmerer, one of the people who Rob painted and was referenced in my conversation with him, asks us really to interrogate that which we are seeing around us. She wrote an essay called Corn Tastes Better on the Honor System. It has totally reshaped the way I see a row of corn. She's inviting us to think about the beingness of the world around us and says, conceiving of plants and land as objects, not subjects, as things instead of beings, provides the moral distance that enables exploitation. Valuing the productive potential of the physical body, but denying the personhood of the being, and she's talking about corn here, reduces a person, corn, to a thing for sale. This too is a manifestation of colonialism. And she goes on to say, there is another word tugging at my sleeve, asking for recognition. That word is slavery. Standing alone in straight lines, in poisoned fields, forced to carry genes not their own. Today, sacred maize is enslaved to an industrial purpose, feeding cars and factories. For me, that connects so closely to what Rob shared about we have exiled the sacred from this realm so that we might harvest a mountain of money, whether that's a mountaintop or the way we relate to corn.
That is such powerful truth-telling, and I'm reminded in this again how truth-telling calls us back into relationship. I think that's part of what Rob was getting at when he shared that, and I'm reminded that those relationships, like all relationships, take time and tending and are filled with joy, but also anxiety and beauty and complexity. I've had some opportunities to spend extended periods of time on working farms, and I'm struck by the profound reciprocity that those working these farms have with the land, with the creatures, the way they know them, and the way the sheep and the goats know them. I've watched someone walk down the road and all of a sudden there's this whole flock of sheep and goats just headed right for the fence. One of the things I also appreciate about Rob's vision is the way that it reminds me that we are not alone in this work. I think I mentioned this right at the beginning, how it feels like we're embedded in this group of people who will never know who are also carrying this work with us. It reminds me of the Christian theological concept of the communion of the saints. As we do this work, we are united across space, but also across time with other people who are joining us in what we're doing, whose lineages and understandings we can build on.
Saints also feels at times like this huge word that is beyond any of our capacities. Rob plays with that in terms of the people he's painting. He's really not trying to present as heroes that the rest of us can never come close to being like. Rob actually has this quote that says, Americans who tell the truth are selected as real, complex human beings whose acts for the common good can be emulated by all of us, by any of us. The saving grace of a healthy democracy is not a handful of heroes, but a culture of engaged citizenship inspired by the courage of truth tellers. So yes, that speaks to the communion of the saints with the idea that any of us and all of us might be those saints. It makes me think of a book that we have engaged with through the past couple years at the BTS Center called Rooted and Rising. It's filled with essays by what I would consider to be a communion of saints doing the work. I just want to shout out some of the names of people in that book who have become really good friends of this organization and this work. Leah Shade, Margaret Bullitt Jonas, Fred Small, Natasha G. Jarnett, Karina Newsom, the producer of this very podcast, Peterson Toscano, Jim Antall, and so many more voices. That book works to bring diversity of perspective forward so that we can know that we are not alone in this work.
I'm going to go back quite a bit farther to an 11th century saint named Brother Isidore, who's the patron saint of farmers and day laborers. And the thing I love about Brother Isidore is we know almost nothing about him, and he did nothing we would consider significant with his life. He was a married medieval peasant who plowed the fields. There are legends of him sharing his food generously with others, of a mysterious white oxen and the angels that would assist him as he plowed, who just led this quiet, humble life. And it's a reminder to me to stay grounded in the concrete, the local, and the real, and to remember that I don't have to save the world. I just have to do my part.
I imagine all of these people we just named and so many more coming into that vision Rob shared of collective courage, standing together with diversity at Standing Rock or some other location that needs community to tell the truth as a way of moving towards healing.
We end each episode of our show by providing you with possible next steps you can take. We recognize that knowing about climate change and being moved by the plight of our world is not enough. But what is enough?
None of us can solve the world's problems alone. But we can take the next meaningful, significant step. When I spoke with Rob, I asked him to share some next steps with us.
There are so many next steps. There is no one next step. Probably everywhere in this country, there are people, organizations, committees, school groups who are trying to do the right thing. Put it this way, none of us is going to make, you know, the big change, which is going to change the world. I mean, there are big changes that need to be made at policy levels, at the highest levels. But until those are made, it's incumbent on all of us to be working locally, you know, to do what we can, partly because of what we can accomplish in terms of green energies and transportation and various things that can happen at a local level, the way we build, the way we do all these things, and the way we get involved in politics locally. That's really important. The thing that happens at that level, though, and we, with our educational work we do, our Samantha Smith Challenge and some of the other educational programs we have, is that you notice with kids, because when you ask them very directly, how do they feel about these issues? We go into schools, we get the kids to talk about what they know about the problem. A lot of them do know about most serious effects of what's going on in the climate, the symptoms. But if you push it further and say, well, how do you feel about it? You know, the kids might say, well, we're terrified. And you say, well, isn't your school doing this or that, you know, to help you with this? Often not. By getting people, kids, but all of us, getting involved and working on some project that works at some level to alleviate, mitigate some of these issues, it changes our emotional relationship with them. Instead of being so fearful, we feel much more positive. We feel like, yes, I can do something. And while we're then in the process of doing those local things, we can also continue to put pressure on, you know, the governments who are not taking care of us in the way that government should, and to make the most serious choices.
I would also encourage people to check out a really amazing documentary that has been done on your work. That's called Truth Tellers, and people can access at truthtellersfilm.com to learn more about some of the people that Rob has lovingly, painstakingly painted portraits of and identified quotes for. And rather than watching it alone, I would encourage you to consider offering a screening of that film in a community that you are connected with, your faith community, a neighborhood school in your area, or even trying to pull together your extended family. I watched that film with my third grader, and it sparked some really meaningful conversation about democracy and a call to tell the truth. I have no doubt it would do the same for your friends and neighbors. Now, what about you, Ben?
My suggestion is to write a note of thanks to someone who is doing courageous work, whose work is perhaps going underrecognized, and the more local, the better, perhaps someone in your neighborhood, your workplace, or your faith community. Many thanks to Rob Shetterly for spending time with us. You can learn more about Rob and see for yourself the portraits of courageous truth tellers he has painted Visit AmericansWhoTellTheTruth.org. That's AmericansWhoTellTheTruth.org.
And thank you for joining Ben, Rob, and me for this episode of the Climate Changed Podcast.
We would love to hear your thoughts and responses to our conversation. We also welcome any suggestions you have for the show.
Feel free to email us at podcast@thebtscenter.org. That's podcast@thebtscenter.org.
Our podcast is produced by Peterson Toscano and is a project of the BTS Center in beautiful Portland, Maine.
Learn more about the BTS Center's upcoming programs and learning resources by visiting thebtscenter.org. That's thebtscenter.org. Thanks, friends. Be well this day.